Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
All righty. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So today we have an amazing founder, you know, a founder that has a remarkable story, you know, very inspiring. You know, you're gonna find how he found a problem and he found every single angle that he could educate himself about it, you know, before he actually took the plunge. But remarkable journey, a rocket ship that he's built. And obviously, you know, a first name and a last name that the origins are from Spain. So from a long time ago, but hey, you know, I'm a little bit biased. I like, you know, like those people that eventually, you know, they're coming from the same country. Why not? Even though we're all here in America. But anyhow, without further ado, brace yourself for impact. Brace yourself for this super interesting conversation ahead of us. So without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Arturo Elizondo. Welcome to the show.
Gracias. Thank you for having me, Alejandro. Great to be here.
It's such a pleasure. So give us a walk through memory lane. So obviously you grew up in the border. So tell us, how was life growing up for you?
Yeah, I'm one of six kids, grew up on both sides of the Texas-Mexico border. And I think from a very early age, just given that the US-Mexico border is the border with the highest income disparity of any two countries in the world, and being on both sides of it made me very aware of the, like, just how different my life would have been. And having a perspective around like that there's a much bigger world around me than just my, you know, my neighborhood or my city. But also growing up I'm one of six kids. We grew up in a very Mexican American household. And, you know, like any good Texans, we had our barbecues every Sunday. Like any good Mexicans had our two extra breakfasts every morning. And I never thought about where my food came from. It wasn't until many years later, but that animal protein was a huge, huge part of my life. And it still is now, but just from a different source.
So obviously, you know, in your case, really spectacular. You land in Harvard, you know, out of all schools, you know, one of the best schools in the world. And I guess that was your segue to starting to get involved with like government and how you eventually, you know, found yourself exposed to agriculture.
Yeah, I think ultimately I think growing up on the border and seeing, like, I remember going across the border with my dad on the weekends. And I remember seeing little kids my age who had no shoes and were selling gum on the street. And I thought, you know, I didn't do anything to deserve what I did. Like, I just happened to be born, you know, a few miles north of the border and to parents that had resources, but I didn't really do anything to deserve this. And that really marked me when I was very little. And it kind of put in me this idea that if I could help improve the lot of others who weren't as lucky and didn't win the lottery of life, then my life would have been worthwhile. And I thought, well, how can I make the biggest possible impact? Even growing up, I was like, oh, I'm not really sure what that looks like. But then I thought government was going to be, you know, maybe government is how I can make a difference. And I thought, well, if I can change one law, even in one small way, I could impact the lives of millions of people. And that idea of scale always fascinated me, even from a little kid when I was younger. And that's why I decided to go to Harvard and study government, thinking, okay, I'm going to work at the UN or become a senator or a congressman and change laws to help, you know, help as many people and as many beings as possible. And then, you know, the more I learned about government and then the more I learned about our food system, that quickly changed.
So what was about the food system that really sparked your interest?
So I don't know if you've seen any of the factory farming videos.
It was pretty disgusting, to say the least.
Yeah. It's one of the things where, like, I wish everyone in the world could see this, because I think if we all knew what we were eating, we would have a very different food system. And I remember being 16 and someone posted a video online of a factory farm. And I never thought about where my food came from. And then I see it was a video of workers inside a factory farm and this guy who grabbed two chickens by the neck and smashed them against the wall. And then these chickens were in these cages on top of each other. And I my immediate reaction was, there's no way this is what I'm eating. Like, there's no way that this is our, this is the norm. This must be an exception. This should be, this is illegal. Like, we need to, you know, these people need to be in jail. And then the more that I looked into it, the more I realized that this is not the exception. It is the norm. We slaughter over a million animals every single hour just in the US to feed less than 5% of the world population. And that what I saw in that video is not the exception. It is how we produce animal protein at scale today, because that is the most efficient way of feeding people.
So obviously, you know, after this, you started to see the problem from many angles, not only government, but then also you did a bunch of internships, for example, in banking. So what would you say was what you needed, you know, for you to be like, okay, you know, it's time for me to take action. I'm packing my bags and I'm going to San Francisco.
Yeah. I mean, the number one piece was understanding the scale. Like, you know, I thought, okay, I want to do scale and I want to do impact at scale and I want to do good for the world. What? How can I spend my time in this earth doing the most good that I can? And I used, you know, that video I watched when I was 16, but the more I kept doing my research and then I interned at the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and then I went to the United Nations and I did my research on global food security. And the more I learned about our food system, the more it blew my mind. And I just, like, it was one crazy statistic after another where I was like, how is no one talking about this? You know, I had no idea that animal agriculture and animal protein production is the number one cause of deforestation on Earth. It is the number one cause of extinction on the planet. 3 out of every 4 emerging infectious diseases, like COVID, like SARS, are zoonotic. They're traced back to animals in a relationship to the natural world. It is a number one, animal protein production is the number one cause of freshwater pollution because of the waste runoff from these factory farms. And our diet, very rich in animal protein and animal fat, is animal, you know, processed meat is a level one carcinogen up there with asbestos and cigarettes by the World Health Organization. And so it just, you know, antibiotic resistance, you know, 70% of the antibiotics in the world today are fed to animals, not to humans. And so I just, like, the more I learned, the more shocked I became, and really the more angry I became. I was like, how is no one talking about this? We need more people to be focusing on this issue. And then I came across, when I was studying global food security, I came across these different technologies out there. And I thought, well, are there ways that we can actually solve the problem? Because I fundamentally didn't believe that we were going to market our way into a better food system, that people will magically wake up and say, hey, you know what? I'm going to, you know, I'm going to go vegan or vegetarian because I love animals or because of the planet. I just didn't think that that was realistic. And my parents, you know, they still eat meat almost every day in Texas. So I knew that that was a long time coming, but I knew that given how big the problem was in terms of its scale and how neglected this problem was, that I realized that there was no more, you know, no better way for me to spend my time on this earth than to tackle this problem.
So 2014, you know, that's the year where everything changes for you. So what happened in 2014?
So I graduated from college and I went to DC. I was interning for Justice Sotomayor at the Supreme Court. And thinking, okay, maybe I should still stay in government, find, you know, I was already on down that path and I didn't want to let it go. But, you know, food kept calling me, but I was like, look, I have no experience in this, in food. I don't have any expertise in biotechnology or in food technology. I just have read a lot about it and I'm very passionate about it, but I don't have any real skills. And then I get a job offer to join the Obama administration as a political appointee. And I called one of my boss from Credit Suisse, actually, my boss's boss from Credit Suisse. And he had been a mentor of mine. And I was so excited. I was like, look, I got this job. It's a great, you know, a great launching pad for my career. And his reaction, it was, what are you doing? You should be in San Francisco working on food tech, the way that, like, working on food the way you've been telling me for the last 18 months you've been wanting to do, as you've been doing all this research, like why aren't you doing this? And it was completely shocked me because I thought he was going to be like, oh my God, that's amazing. Congratulations. You should take it. And I wanted someone to validate my choice. And so for him to say that made me realize, you know what? I made me like take a step back and say, man, like, what am I doing? And I realized as the more I thought about it, that I was scared. I was scared to go down a path that I didn't know what it would look like. It was this big question mark. It's like, I don't know anything about startups. I don't know anything about venture capital. I don't know anything about these things. And I was scared to make a leap. But I think being aware of that fear helped me identify and say, maybe I can find a way to still make it work. And I said, let me give myself 6 months and see if I can make it, figure something out. And so the next day after that call, I booked a one-way ticket to San Francisco. I had no job. I had no place to stay. But I thought, you know what? I don't want to be on my deathbed saying like, what if? What if I had tried?
So what happened next?
So I posted on Facebook asking if anyone knew of any dog sitters or cat sitters, of any couches that I could stay on while I was in San Francisco. And so I found something and a couple of friends offered. And I stayed with one of my friends and started networking my ass off, emailing every person I could. And I was like, look, I have 6 months to see if I can make this work. And I was still interviewing at other places just to be on the safe side and like to keep some options open. But I emailed everybody I could, and I grabbed coffee with all these impact investors. I thought maybe if I join venture capital, I can do something that I can learn about the space, build some skills, and then jump into something that where I can like jump into a startup. And one of I met this guy who started another food tech company, and I was like, hey, I really want to be a part of this. You know, what can I do? And he's like, come to this conference with me. You know, it's one of the first ever food tech conferences, because 10 years ago, food tech wasn't really a thing. There were probably two companies in the world really doing something in it, Beyond Meat and Hampton Creek at the time. And that was before Impossible Foods or others had commercialized or existed in any real way. And I show up to this conference, and that day he doesn't end up going to the conference. So I find this empty chair and the only table with young people in it. I sit down, and little did I know, I'm sitting next to this molecular biologist who had this crazy idea of making eggs without chickens and proteins without animals, and a couple of other folks. And New Harvest, this nonprofit, Isha from there, brought him to that conference to see the space and learn more about it. And she brought us together, and we went to a coffee shop and started cranking out a business plan.
Hey guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard. And already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on, when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of a cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out.
So that's how, you know, all the good stuff happens. So the everyday company is born at this point. So I guess, what what ended up being the business model of the Everyday Company? How do you guys make money?
Yeah, so the core idea was you can use biotechnology is an industry that has been is a technology that has been primarily employed in pharma. So almost every protein-based drug, therapeutic, vaccine is made using a fermentation technology, through using fermentation. The philosophy was, we've made all these animal proteins through fermentation for pharma, which is a very, you know, you can use a very sexy technology to make these products at very, very high prices. But the question was, can we democratize access to this technology and optimize it so that we can make other kinds of animal proteins at scale at cost levels where we can start selling into the world's biggest food companies that are using billions of dollars worth of animal proteins as ingredients. And that's where that was the basic idea, is can we use this fermentation technology to make all kinds of animal proteins, not just for medicine, but for food. And we raised, you know, 50K in cash, and they gave us 3 months of lab space through IndieBio, which is a biotech accelerator program. And the business model was, we're going to make these proteins really efficiently using yeast instead of chickens or pigs or cows, instead of using animals, and then ferment them and then sell them off to big food companies and help them have a much more efficient and de-risked supply chain with the same kind of functionality and quality of the products that they already use in their hundreds of applications. You go to any grocery store and you look at the back of the label of almost any food product out there, and on the back it says, you know, they have egg protein, right? Or dairy proteins or other or different kinds of animal proteins. Like, you know, Guinness was the beer company, was still using fish bladders to filter their beers up until 7 years ago. And so you see this huge use of animal proteins throughout the food system that no one even knows about. And so we could replace them using much more efficient protein factories in animals, like microorganisms. Then we could really make a difference in decarbonizing our food system and also working with the world's biggest food companies to make them more sustainable.
So obviously, you know, a business like this is capital intensive. So how much capital have you guys raised to date, and what has been the experience of going through the different rounds?
We've raised over $240 million of capital, and we have used that over the course of 8+ years. The first 6 years, we're developing the core technology. And at that time, you know, in the beginning, because we don't have the same metrics that software companies have, and we're much more capital intensive before you see any revenues, but we're not really a pharma company. It's, you know, it's confusing to a lot of investors. Like, how should we look at you? Because you're not a software company and you're not a pharma company. You're kind of in between. You're very capital intensive. And so a big part of it for the first several years was selling the vision. Like, hey, like, this is how it's going to work. This is the problem at hand. This is how big the opportunity can be. And then really working, like, especially like finding ways to de-risk the technology. Like, can you actually get a yeast to make animal protein more efficiently than an animal can make it? And so we had to make a lot of technology progress there. And then at the same time, we had to sell these, you know, work with these big food companies and share with them, you know, what we were doing. And then, and fortunately, a lot of big food companies are trying to get rid of those ingredients because they do this. They're inconsistent. The pain points are very, very high. And so we were able to tell that story, you know, for the first several years until we really were able to prove ourselves. And now, you know, we have all the regulatory approvals. You know, we got our products, you know, have been in the hands of, you know, at 11 Madison Park. That's where we launched our egg. It was voted the best restaurant in the world. We got it in the hands of probably arguably the world's toughest food critic, Laurence Fabricant of the New York Times, with very positive reviews. And we have now some of the world's biggest food companies saying, you know, when can we get our hands on it? And so now we're starting to start scaling the business. So we're at that inflection point today.
My God. So how do you do it being 10 years in it, you know, until you finally, you know, come out of the desert? You know, like, what do you think kept you guys going for so long?
I think what kept us going, as probably a lot of people relate, is I mean, for me, like, this is very personal. I started the company when I was 22. Like, I had And I've grown a lot as a leader. I wouldn't have hired myself, 8 years ago when I, just by virtue of how much growing up I needed to do. But I realized actually, for me at least, what has kept me through has been like, this needs to exist, and it will. The technology works. And I think what has kept us going is every week or every month and every quarter, there's like something big like that's happening where has fundamentally changed and given us more conviction. So even though it's a long haul, it's been really powerful to see, oh, like we got the FDA approval. Oh, like the world's, the world's largest, whatever, like winemaker, like loves the product. Oh, this restaurant loves it. And now, we exceeded this yield. We scaled the technology to this level. So every little milestone, I think for me, allows me to underwrite the business in a much deeper way, in a way that in the beginning, I was selling a vision. Like I was kind of scared to pitch because on the one hand, I love what we're doing, but on the other hand, like we don't have the proof. Like we don't know if it's actually going to work. And to pitch that is really hard. And now it's like, okay, we know it's going to work. Now it's a matter of just having enough time and capital to ensure that we have the resources to take this company to where, to domination. But like it works. The products work. The technology works. It scales. Like, and that I think has helped, has made me, and I think a lot of our team members, continue believing in what we're doing because now we have proof.
So talking about vision there, let's double click on that. Let's say you were to go to sleep tonight, Arturo, and you wake up in a world where the vision for the everyday company is fully realized. What does that world look like?
Yeah, it means that the foods actually look very similar. A lot of products are like looking much healthier, but ultimately is that when where people don't have to turn their brains off when they're eating, where they don't have to say, I don't want to think about where this food is coming from. I just want to enjoy the food. Is that we can eat these foods and celebrate where they're coming from. Our vision is a world where we're not using factory farms to make food, to make animal protein, where we don't have to stack animals on top of each other and have them suffer in ways that are just unimaginable. And yet we're doing it at the, in the quantities of billions, and our planet is dying because of it. The vision is that is no longer needed. We have better, we can make protein from breweries instead of factory farms.
It's incredible how, obviously you guys have been at it now for about 10 years. As you were saying, like everything that you've learned along the way, you were talking about like even not hiring, your younger self. So let's talk about that for a second. Let's go a little bit deeper here. Let's say I was to put you into a time machine and we arrive at 2014, that moment where you're maybe at a Starbucks, like crafting that business plan together, with your, co-founders. And let's say you had the opportunity of showing up right there and sitting down with your younger self and perhaps, with your other colleagues. And you had the opportunity of giving that younger self one piece of advice before launching a business. What would that be and why, given what you know now 10 years in?
Yeah, man, that's a very deep question. And I'm very conflicted because there's a part of me that's like, I don't think of anything, like, I don't know if I would have believed anything that I would have told myself then because I was just because I needed to like see it, believe it. And like all, I got so much advice, but it like, I had to like, I wasn't like embodying it. I think the piece of advice would be to do psychedelics earlier. Because ultimately, for me, the big piece that I've been working through is ultimately like owning my power and like believing in it. And I think for like several years, like I felt like, man, I'm selling this vision, and I couldn't underwrite it with the proof. It was selling this dream, and it was like very mentally taxing because I'm taking investor money, and I don't know if I'm going to be able to return it and make it work. So I think the advice that I would have given myself is number one is go to therapy as soon as possible, get an executive coach and work with psychedelics as early as possible and like do the work on yourself so that you can be the best leader you can to lead this company and lead it with conviction.
So that's amazing. Very profound. So for the people that are listening, that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
Yeah, I'm on LinkedIn. My email is also arturo@evry.com. Yeah, and also the one thing that I would have loved my younger self to know is you don't have to compromise. Like to say, hey, you can do good in the world and get the professional like development and like have the job of your dreams, both professionally and also like doing good. You don't have to work at a nonprofit. You don't have to, you know, work in government exclusively. There are incredible ways that business can be a force for good. And I think early on, I just demonized business. I demonized the private sector. I was like, oh, I don't want to be a sellout. And I think, you know, I realized that for me in my life now, this working using technology is the best and most impactful way that I can make a difference in the world. And I would urge everyone to like that we live in a world where you don't have to sell. You don't have to compromise and sell out, that you can do really well for yourself doing good for the world. And the biggest problems in the world are going to be also the most lucrative.
I love it. Well, Arturo, I have to thank you really, you know, for being with us. Such an honor to have you today on the Dealmakers podcast. And yeah, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Alejandro.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening and see you at the next episode.